I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, it is Tuesday, March 28th. I've been told I'm supposed to say Tuesday. It's Tuesday, March 28th. All this week, we're doing a best of queue, but I want to let you know, if you're not already subscribed to our podcast, please do. You can subscribe by, you know, Apple Podcasts or Spotify or, you know, CBC Listen, wherever you get your podcast, you can check that out there. All right, show starts now. You might have heard the news that the Spice Girls turned down the offer to play the coronation of King Charles. Now, however you feel about that decision, it does kind of make sense. For a big pop group, the Spice Girls have always done their own thing. Melanie C, or Sporty Spice, has a new memoir, and she talks about that. The Spice Girls defying expectations of a pop group and the struggles that come with worldwide fame. That's coming up. Plus, one of the best records to come out of Canada this year belongs to Asa Nabi, a musician who did something really interesting. He sat down with his grandfather, who is a residential school survivor, and interviewed him about his life and turned his stories into songs. Asa Nabi will be here to tell you that story. That's coming up. My name is Tom Power. You are listening to Q. So for most of her life, Melanie C has been known as Sporty Spice, or like the sporty one. She got that nickname when she was around 20, when she joined a little known obscure pop group. So yeah, the Spice Girls, scary, ginger, baby, posh, and sporty. In 1996, their first single, Wannabe, reached number one in 37 countries. Their debut album, Spice, is still the world's best-selling album from a female music group. For people in my generation especially, there was kind of no bigger group in the world. There were like pencil cases and feature films and posters in your locker. But as you probably know, that level of fame comes with its own set of challenges. And Melanie C, or Sporty Spice, is honest about that in her new memoir. It's called The Sporty One, My Life as a Spice Girl. And we sat down to talk about it. And she opened up about a lot of different things, things you may not have known or might have assumed about being the biggest girl band in the world. But we started out by talking about being in a band for so long, how nice it was to tell her own story. Here's my conversation with Melanie C.
How are you?
Hey, I'm good. Lovely to speak to you.
Congratulations on the book. How are you feeling now that it's out there?
Yeah, you know, it's such a journey kind of making the decision to write it and then actually getting down and writing it. And then once it's out there for the world to see, and I think I probably feel more relief now than anything. It's been so beautifully received and that feels good. It's nice to get your story out in your words. You know, I think so many people in the public eye, we have such a perception of them and often other people are telling their story. So it's nice to have the opportunity to do it for yourself.
I mean, especially you, someone who's been in the press. I think there's one part of the book where you say that like any day you could Google the name of your band. And Every single day there's a new news story about you. So there must be something about it, about being able to tell your own story a little bit.
Yeah, totally. You know, it's incredible. I think that's just what's so wonderful about being a Spice Girl. You know, it's obviously as a band, we don't really work together that regularly anymore. We'll do the occasional get together and do some shows, but we haven't really released music since the early noughties, but still written about every day, at least one of us.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how it all happened. So early on in your memoir, you talk about seeing, and I love this, you see an ad that if you didn't see, your life would have turned out completely differently. It was 1994. You were 20 years old. You were a trained dancer. Do you remember what the ad said?
Yeah, I think it features in the book, actually. But it was something along the lines of, are you 18 to 24 years old, outgoing, love to sing, dance, and various other things. And it was funny because I'd been auditioning for West End shows. And that particular day, I was at a cruise audition. And I never wanted to do a cruise because I was so focused on working in the West End. I mean, I wanted to work in music, but like, no one gets that opportunity, right? So I was trying to work in theatre. And I was handed this flyer and I was just like, that's it. That's what I'm going to do. And that band went on to become the Spice Girls.
It says, yeah, that you're right. Are you 18 to 24 with the ability to sing and dance? And then I love it says, are you streetwise, outgoing, ambitious, and dedicated? Isn't that great?
So great. I think I can tick all the boxes. Maybe not streetwise.
What song, to tell everybody what song you sang. I love the choice of what song you sang at your audition.
Oh my gosh. So, well, my mum's a singer. So when I was growing up, there was always lots of musicians rehearsing in the house, and I knew she had some sheet music. And I had some too, because we had to take it along for the pianist to play when we performed. But all of the sheet music I had was musical theatre. And I was thinking, that definitely isn't streetwise. You know, this, I want to be in this cool band. I don't think singing Andrew Lloyd Webber or Stephen Sondheim's going to do it. So I called my mum and she was reading through all these different, like, pure 80s songs she had. And I chose I'm So Excited, Pointer Sisters. I'm so excited. Which is a song I love. I knew it was in a good key for me. I'm about to lose control and I think I like it. So that is what I did.
And you sang, I'm so excited. And then, in like, it's amazing that, like, then you get some kind of, like, tonsil infection. And I love that they call you to see, like, are you going to be in the band? And your mom has to call them and say, well, she can't do it, actually. She has a tonsil infection. She's, like, it's so normal. I know.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy. So I went to the initial audition and I got my call back. And yeah, you're right. I was really sick. I was having terrible tonsillitis at the time. I couldn't speak, let alone sing. So, you know, my mum had to make the call and beg them to give me another chance. And they were like, no, sorry, we got the girls. We picked the girls now. And I thought, oh, well, you know, when you're a performer, you get used to disappointment. You just like dust yourself off and carry on, you know. But they called me back and one of the girls hadn't worked out. And they invited me down and I met Jerry, Mel B, Victoria, and there was a girl called Michelle at the time. But from that day, I was part of the band.
Michelle, who kept sunning herself instead of rehearsing.
She
was out in the sun. I'm glad you mentioned that because I love reading about how you met all the other Spice Girls for the first time. So I thought I'd try something with you. I'm going to throw out their names, and in just a couple of words, can you give me the first impression you got of each of them? All right, let's start out with Scary Spice, Mel B.
Okay. Mel B, I thought, was the coolest person I had ever met. She had on like this varsity jacket and a Kangol hat and baseball boots. She was a Northern girl like me. She's from Yorkshire and more Lancashire. But it was nice to hear that Northern twang. And she was just loud and brash and brave. And I just loved her.
Ginger Spice or Jerry Halliwell?
Okay, so Ginge. She had these little bunches in. She had bright ginger hair at the time. She used to wear these like vintage bras. I think they were from like the 40s that gave you quite pointy boobs. And then she had like this pink mohair sweater. You know, she's got these really sparkly eyes that are super wide. And she was just babbling, you know, 10 to the dozen. And I just thought, she's the kookiest person I've ever met.
Victoria Adams or Victoria Beckham, Posh Spice?
Uh-huh. So Victoria was a little more reserved, very cool. She was sitting, probably legs crossed, looking a lot smarter than everybody else. And, you know, wasn't the most outspoken person, but when she did speak, it was usually something very cutting and very funny.
Baby Spice, Emma Bunton, who, by the way, was 17 when she showed up to join the Spice Girls.
17! Can you believe that?
What did you make of her?
Oh my gosh. So we met her. We were living in a place called Maidenhead, which is outside of London. We were living in this house and we needed this fifth member. You know, we were one member short. And our singing teacher at the time told us about this girl. She's got a great voice. She's lovely. And we met her at the train station and she had on, I think, did she have on like a little dungaree or a little dungaree kind of baby doll dress thing and like some like pulled up socks and, you know, these big blue eyes, beautiful blonde hair. And she just looks so innocent with this big, lovely smile. I mean, the thing I love about Emma is it's like, you know, and it's like the ones who look the most innocent are the naughtiest. But we saw Emma and we just fell in love with her. And it felt like this final piece of the jigsaw had you know, come into place, and this energy was just so frenetic between us, and we felt like we had something very magical.
And you did. I mean, through the jigs and the reels, the band ends up getting together. It ends up sort of moving away from the original people who helped put the band together. You end up, I mean, in some ways, I'm glad you said that thing off the top that you said, that this is the story of telling your own story, because I'm a fan of the Spice Girls. I was born in 87, so like I was pure, excellent age.
Perfect
for the Spice Girls, right? but I'm a great fan of pop music, but even I, and I was talking to my friends about this, we weren't as aware about how in control of everything the Spice Girls actually were. So let's just start with Wannabe, right? Wannabe, yeah. Massive instant hit, is considered scientifically to be one of the most catchy songs of all time, the best-selling single by a female group in the world, written in part, but written by the Spice Girls. Yo, I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want. Don't tell me what you want, what you really, really want. I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want. Don't tell me what you want, what you really, really want. I wanna really, really, really wanna zig a zig. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we were lucky enough to meet Matt and Biff, Matt Rowe and Richard Stannard, who is Biff, who are great songwriters. And they'd had success in the UK, and we were very keen to work with them. And they really nurtured us. And, you know, Biff is, he's incredible at that, really developing young artists. And I think it was the energy that they really wanted to capture. And we were so inexperienced, you know, we all love to sing, we all love to dance. None of us really play any instruments to a good enough level to be able to perform on stage or to use them in a writing session. So, you know, it was really about us just shouting out ideas, shouting out melodies. If you want to be my lover, you have got to give. Taking it too easy, but that's the way it is. Wow. Wannabe was just that, you know, it was the chaos of the Spice Girls. We wanted it to kind of just capture that energy and be the introduction to the world. But so different, you know, because, you know, and no disrespect to anybody, but if you look at like the your contemporaries of the time, your Backstreet Boys and your NSYNCs, you know, these were often written by Max Martin. These were written by sort of like people over in Sweden somewhere. And it was just mm-hmm. amazing to see that like the five of you, this band, put these songs together, you know.
Yeah, it was, you know, everything that happened, we look back and we're like, whoa, you know, we're so lucky just the way it worked out, because we had zero experience. You know, we were put together by a management group. They, you know, they wanted us to be a certain way, but we just didn't feel like that was right for us. Even though, you know, musically we didn't have the experience, you know, we were all performers and we were all young girls, you know, growing up from very different parts of England, but with similar experiences, you know, and we wanted to share that and we wanted to express that. And that was, you know, that was so good for us because it made it feel very homegrown as well, you know, that we were able to get in with British songwriters. And I think there is something very British about the Spice Girls.
And but given that, I mean, you mentioned that you were all contributing individually to the Spice Girls. It was very homegrown. It was very, very organic, I would say, especially for a pop group of the era. But that didn't stop the press from calling you a manufactured, factory made pop band. And Rolling Stone, I think it's Rolling Stone, compares you to the Village People. Fun to stay at the YMCA.
It's fun to stay at the YMCA. Not random, is that?
What is it like, honest to God though, what is it like on a human level to have to deal with that?
Yeah, I think it's really difficult, especially when you're young, because it's frustrating, you know, and this is at a time before social media. So you didn't have this immediate voice to answer back with.
This is a hate mail. We ain't no Spice Girls fan. No, merci. Do yourself a favour and change your image. Sporty Spice, you ain't no sporty gal.
You know, everyone has an opinion, and I know as a young person, I used to get really angry and frustrated with that. As you get older, I think, you know, you start to realise it really doesn't matter. Everybody has an opinion, and, you know, other people's opinion of you really are none of your business. It's probably the best way to go about life. But it's tough. It was tough, and it kind of makes you, it can make you quite confused as well, you know, because you know who you are, but then you're reading about this person and you don't recognise that person. And so it makes you think, gosh, am I this person I feel I am, or am I this person people say I am? So I think it can be really unnerving for young artists.
For you, you would have this perception of yourself, and you would read someone else's negative perception of you, and you would go, oh my God, am I actually that?
Yeah, totally. I think, you know, especially if you're bombarded with it from so many angles, it just becomes so much noise that you really, it's hard to navigate.
But on the same side, I mean, Wannabe just blows up. I mean, when did you know that song was taking off? Like, when did you know this band was actually going to start, this was not just happening, but happening on a level that really no one had seen before?
Yeah. Well, we were always really ambitious. And I think something that really helped our success is that we were very single-minded. And we were always told, you know, in the very beginning, you know, girls, don't get ahead of yourself. It's really hard to make it in the industry. And, you know, we knew that. We didn't want to be arrogant, but we thought if we had self-belief, that was the only way we were going to have any chance of achieving the things we wanted to. So we had this like real support of each other, and we knew we had something precious. So we never for a second doubted we weren't going to be successful. That just wasn't an option. But then, of course, when Wannabe was released, and I think it was before the song was actually released as a single in the UK, we were doing a few like little road shows and stuff going around the country, and loads of people were like singing the song back to us.
If you want to be my lover, you have got to hear.
You've got to hear.
And we're like, whoa, this is wild. You know, like, people know our song. Then when it was released, it went in, I think the midweek was number 6. It ended up being at number 3. Then it went to number 1 in the second week, stayed there for 6 weeks. And we were in Japan at the time when we eventually got to number 1. So when we returned back to London and we finally got on the top of the pop studios.
I wear the Spice Girls later on top of the car.
We realized that was it then. Life had changed forever.
Yeah, it really had. And because let's be clear about something. We were just talking for a second about the criticism you were getting. And we were just talking that just then about the massive success you were having. And you were tough. Like, you were tough mm-hmm. with the criticism, like, as much as, you know, I know it stung. Can you tell one of my favorite stories in the book? Can you tell the story of, and this didn't make the news over in Canada, of Liam Gallagher from Oasis says mm-hmm. something about you. I mean, I get you to say what mm-hmm. that is. And then you, Melanie, you mm-hmm. get on stage and you get on TV and you say something back. Can you tell that story?
Yeah. So I'm a huge Oasis fan. I mean, Britpop was such a great time for British music. And Liam Gallagher at the Brits in 96, we were there, but we were unreleased. So people didn't really know who we were. And I think Liam got up to accept one of the awards and he like offered the audience like out to have a fight.
Anyone who's tough enough to come and take us off this stage, I'm going to talk all night now.
Because this is Britain in the 90s, right? It was pretty hedonistic. Everyone was having a good time. But Liam wanted to fight everybody. Then fast forward to the Brits 97, which is the year of the Union Jack dress. And a few days before the Brits, Liam had said in the newspapers he mightn't go because if he saw the Spice Girls, he'd want to slap us. So when we went up for one of our awards, I thought it was quite a good opportunity to say to Liam, come and have a go if you think you're hard enough.
I just want to say, Liam, come and have a go if you think you're hard enough.
Come and have a go, Liam, if you think you're hard enough.
Come and have a go if you think you're hard enough, which is a bit of a British kind of, you know, old school way of offering somebody out to have a fight.
Yeah, Northern too.
You know, yeah. And you know, it was just a bit of fun. And the funny thing was, I met him for the first time properly a couple of years later. And he was actually dating a friend of mine. And he turned up at a friend's house that I was at. And and we've kind of been quite good friends ever since, really. But it was definitely a fun moment.
When he saw you, when he met you years later, he put up his fist like he was going to...
He did. He put up his fist and he said, come on then, Scouse.
Because at the same time, and it's like, again, like of the era that I'm at, and Vanessa, who produced this piece, like we were just talking about it, that like it was so formative for so many people, especially for young women who like... I mean, girl power became this like rallying cry for so many people. You know, I remember in like my elementary school, just people walking around yelling girl power. But like you write in the book about how the Spice Girls break out at the same time as the Riot Girl movement happens in America, that you were aware of those bands happening. You shared actually a lot of the same values when it came to feminism, but you wanted to express feminism in a different way. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, I think with the Spice Girls, it was difficult because, you know, the genre of music that we were making and still do, you know, as a solo artist, I'm still a pop artist. And it was kind of, it was looked down on at the time, you know. So of course, you know, like movements like Riot Girl, you know, there's, it was a much cooler genre of music. And I think, you know, even talking about feminism, it's something which to me has always been more intellectual. And I think there were probably lots of people out there ready to criticize that, you know, we weren't who we said we were. You know, like you said, people said we were manufactured. People said there was men behind it. I mean, come on, there's men behind every music act, because the music industry is still a male-dominated industry, particularly in labels, right? But we were expressing ourselves in one, the way that felt comfortable to us. You know, we were super genuine because we grew up listening to pop music. You know, we weren't trying to be anything we weren't. We wanted to make pop music, but we still felt it was important to be a girl band for girls. And, you know, it didn't start out like that. We went to record labels and we were told that girl bands don't sell. And that was the best thing that could have ever happened to us, because we just thought, F you, we're going to prove everybody wrong.
Yeah, whether you're a fan or not, Spice Girl mania has rocked the world.
And that literally gave us the opportunity to have this platform and to change so many things for so many people. And what I love about the Spice Girls is it was so mainstream that it was able to reach so many people, and really young fans as well. We had fans of like 3 and 4 years of age. And I think that's what made us stand the test of time.
I mean, and at the same time, you are doing things behind the scenes which are even more radical, even for now. I mean, Spice Girls have been fighting to control their music since day one, and you sing about it on the song, Who Do You Think You Are? Can you talk to me a little bit about what inspired that song?
Yeah, so when we were in the sessions writing Spice, this particular song, because, you know, we were always talking about, you know, what we wanted to say and the things we were going through. And we'd had some experience at that point meeting record companies and executives and management, predominantly middle-aged men. And yeah, that was just our thoughts and feelings around, you know, that energy that we found in the music industry. It was all these guys who just, yeah, they control everything or feel they control everything. And we wanted to, yeah, just kind of stick two fingers up to it. The race is on to get out of the bottom. The top is high.
That is the Spice Girls and Who Do You Think You Are? More to come with my conversation with Melanie C, or Sporty Spice from the Spice Girls. She talks about what happens when you're struggling with an eating disorder and you are maybe the most photographed person in the world at the time. Plus the Canadian singer Asa Nabi, who did a really hard thing. He talked to his family about their past and then made a record about it. That's after this on EQ.
Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, the only things I could control was what I ate or didn't eat. And when I was in the gym, it was my escape. And it just kind of, you know, it took time for me to get to a place where it was an illness. But I think over that 2 years, it kind of, you know, it got to a pretty bad place.
I mean, just unbelievable to think about struggling with an eating disorder while at the same time being photographed by every single magazine in the world. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. You're listening to the Spice Girls and Viva Forever. And you're in the middle of my conversation with Melanie C, or Sporty Spice from the Spice Girls. It's been 25 years since the release of their album Spice World, 25 years since they were the biggest pop band in the world. What's amazing now is how quickly it happened. In her new memoir, The Sporty One, Melanie talks about joining the Spice Girls when she was 20. And in 2 short years, she goes from anonymity to being one of the most photographed people in the world. What does that do to you, to have that kind of visibility, to have that change happen in your life so fast? Well, it's not easy, and she was open with me about that. Just a warning, this conversation does touch on eating disorders. Here's more of my conversation with Melanie C. In the memoir, speaking of stuff that was happening behind the scenes that the fans didn't know about, in the memoir, you open up about something very personal. And Melanie, I don't want to get you to talk about this as much as you want to talk about it, but you write about how during your time in the Spice Girls, you developed an eating disorder. When did that begin for you?
I think it was quite a gradual thing that escalated. And it was a few comments about my physical appearance. And, you know, probably quite innocent comments, throwaway comments by, you know, a particular person in the first management company we were with. And it just struck a chord with me. And I was so determined to take this opportunity. And, you know, it was my childhood dream to work in music. And some of these comments, they just kind of wobbled me. And I thought, whoa, do I not look the way I need to look to achieve this? And I started to restrict my eating, and I was started to exercise more and more. And, I think throughout the girls, it wasn't something that happened overnight. But with the added pressure of being written about in the media, being criticized, being photographed constantly, it just made me very self-conscious about my appearance. These are complex issues that sadly lots of people face in life. And I think a huge part of it as well is control. You know, we were in this incredible, you know, we were on an incredible ride,
yeah,
and experiencing our wildest dreams, but your life is not your own. You know, there's an incredible amount of pressure on you from the outside, from the inside. You know, we never wanted to let each other down. And yeah, the only things I could control was what I ate or didn't eat. And when I was in the gym, it was my escape. And it just kind of, you know, it took time for me to get to a place where it was an illness. But I think over that 2 years, it kind of, you know, it got to a pretty bad place.
I'm struck by what you said there. You said there was a tremendous amount of pressure because you were on this incredible ride. But there was also, you said there was also a pressure not to let one another down, that you, five of you had committed so much to this. But I also know that Jerry, Ginger, and Victoria Posh have also spoken about their own experiences with eating disorders during that time. I mean, was that something you guys talked about, or was it, I mean, it must be in hindsight to be able to know that you were all experiencing that at the same time, you know?
Jerry has been very open and talked about her issues, and it's something that she was suffering with before we got together as a band, but we were unaware. You know, and Jerry's had her issues with that for a number of years. You know, I think anybody who suffers these things, it's a very personal thing.
Yeah.
And I was really ashamed. I was trying to hide it. Yeah, I was so embarrassed. I was so ashamed and embarrassed of the way I was eating. And, you know, I think like lots of people with eating disorders, it's, you know, it's just no way to live, because eating is such an important part of life. You know, I would avoid social situations and I'd be very self-conscious around people if I was eating. And yeah, it, I mean, it's a waste of a life. It makes me feel really sad. And I kind of, it would be lovely to go back and know what I know now.
Because it's your life from the outside would seem kind of sunny, right? Like that,
yeah,
that
you got everything.
Yeah, everything. I mean, you were in the biggest band in the world. You were, yeah. I mean, not many people get to be in that situation,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I never want to take away the joy,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
I wouldn't change anything.
Yeah.
You know, it was incredible. But like everything in life, you know, there's dark sides to things. And it's the truth. You know, I think we look at people, we live in this age now, don't we, the Instagram age, and everybody's life looks perfect.
Yeah.
Nothing's perfect. I had everything. I'd just come off the back of the biggest successful time with the Spice Girls. I was making, you know, my own solo record, which is my most successful record as a solo artist. I had the home, I had the car, you know, I had money in the bank, I had all the things, and I was at my lowest point in my life. I was lonely, I was depressed, I was battling issues, and, you know, and then you feel guilty because you just think, like, I've got everything. How dare I not feel happy? So I think it's really important to express those things, because whatever world you're from, whatever walk of life you're from, we can all experience these things.
Yeah, I really appreciate you sharing that. I thought it was really powerful. You go on to have your own solo career. I loved Going Down when it first came out so much, by the way. I remember that video. I remember that video on Much Music here in Canada and losing my mind.
Yay.
But this is a Canadian show, so I got to ask about When You're Gone. I got to ask about the duet
of
with Bryan Adams.
So Brian, oh my gosh, I mean, I have so much to thank him for. It was just wonderful. We just had a chance meeting in a lift in LA, in a hotel. And my mum was a huge fan, and he was kind enough to come and say hi and spend some time with us. And we just stayed in touch, and he called me up and said, hey, I've got this song. I think you'd sound great on it. And I was like, yeah. I hadn't even heard the song, but thank goodness it was an incredible song. And yeah, a little bit of trivia for you now. Mm. So he wrote that with a guy called Elliot Kennedy, who also wrote Say You'll Be There with the Spice Girls. So I knew it was going to be a great song. And that was my first thing to do without the girls. And Brian just put so much faith in me, and it gave me the confidence to go on and then make a solo record.
By the way, what a great line is, if you put two and two together, you will see what our friendship is for.
If you put two and two together, you will see what our friendship is for. Oh, if you can work this equation, then I'll guess I'll have to show you the door.
Wordsmith.
I love that line, man. I love that line.
I'm mathematicians at the same time.
Is that you? Are you singing that? Is that your line?
I think it's Jerry, isn't
it? I think it's Jerry.
I think I do a little harmony on the second half of the line.
Yeah. I think you're the first verse. But I can tell that going solo, like that record, I mean, you can tell it just made you breathe so much more freely, you know?
Oh my goodness. You know what? Being a Spice Girl is the best thing ever.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm part of that gang, and it's very collaborative, and we make this music that is us and the energy we share. But having the opportunity to be an individual and really express yourself in that way and like dive deep into your thoughts, feelings and emotions, it was so liberating for me. And of course, I had the opportunity to work with the most incredible people like Rick Knowles and Rick Rubin and Marius DeVries and William Orbit. I mean, the list is endless. It was just a magical time. And I look back so fondly at those sessions for Northern Star, because you know, when people just talk about their first album, even though it wasn't my first, I'd done two with the girls already, but for me, it was the first. And it was like a whole life's worth of emotion and experience that I was able to draw upon.
You said something earlier that I caught, but I wanted to stick with. You said something like, yeah, you know, Spice Girls, we don't really make music anymore, but we still do, you know, like we're still, you talk about Spice Girls in the present tense, like an is, not a was.
It is. You know, it's so funny because people always, well, not always, but often refer to me as former Spice Girl. And I'm like, whoa. Once a Spice Girl, always a Spice Girl. And, you know, we're constantly talking. We toured back in 2019. And yeah, I mean, every day, this is what was so wonderful about the shows we did. The UK and Ireland, we did these great stadium shows in 2019. And it just made me realize that I am Sporty Spice and Melanie C. You know, I'm a solo artist. I'm part of the band. And I'm all the things all the time. You know, I used to go through, I'm not very good at multitasking. So I used to think I had to be that person at that point. You know, I had to put that hat on. But now I realize, no, it's all within me. And yeah, I completely and fully embrace being a Spice Girl every day.
I hope you're like the Rolling Stones. Like, I hope you guys are still going out. Like,
yeah, me too. You know, the backflip's gone now. I think that's off. But I was nervous when I got back on stage in 2019. I did wonder, like, how much energy I'd still have. Yeah. You know, would I feel ridiculous jumping around to Wannabe? And the answer was no. Yeah. I felt amazing, and I just think it's one of those moments. You know, I think for the audience as well, as soon as you hear that song, you maybe go back to your 10-year-old self or wherever you were at the time. And yeah, it feels exactly the same for us girls up there.
10-year-old self. Can I tell you the truth? When I was 12 years old, I had my first kiss to a Spice Girls song.
No, which song was it?
Viva Forever.
Viva, oh, romantic, I like
yeah,
it. Nice
yeah.
guitar solo in there.
Yeah, we were dancing at the Count Heights Dance in St. John's, Newfoundland. And I remember,
I
have Viva Forever playing, and I remember a guy was like, kiss her, man, kiss her. You gotta kiss her. And I was like, oh, I don't want to do it, I'm too scared. But Viva Forever helped me out.
Yeah, and how did it go? I mean, the first kiss is pretty, you know, usually pretty terrible.
Oh, I think. Imagine if I said, like, no, we're still together. It was your first kiss peck. Was that your first kiss experience? Like, you know, that's like the quick, that was the peck.
Okay, yeah. We did a bit of hand-holding before the kiss.
Was there a song? Yeah. Were you listening to, I don't know, the Pointer Sisters?
I remember holding a guy's hand ice skating once. Aww. Yeah. Yeah, that was a big deal. I wonder what was playing. I want to say Belinda Carlisle.
Well, listen. Childhood traumas aside, there's a beautiful line in your memoir, and maybe this is a good way to close things out. You write, "Does anyone survive fame unscathed? If you had the chance to choose this path again, would you?"
100%. I wouldn't change anything. I mean, of course I would, you know, I'd have made some different decisions along the way, but you know, it's so funny, isn't it? Because we often talk about regrets, and it's a real waste of energy because you can't go back and you can't change things. But all we can do is learn and grow from those things. And, you know, again, that's why it's been so important for me to just kind of lift the lid on fame a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
I think so many people aspire to be famous, and I think we live in such different times now where, you know, fame is a very different thing, but it still has a dark side. It's not all fun and games. You know, you have to be prepared. If that's a life you want to go into, you know, you have to be ready.
Well, I really enjoyed reading it, and it was such a lovely, I don't know, it was just such a lovely perspective on a time of all of our lives through your life, you know.
Thank you.
Lovely to meet you.
So lovely to meet you. Thank you so much.
That was Melanie C., also known as Sporty Spice. Her memoir is called The Sporty One, My Life as a Spice Girl. The Spice Girls have also released an anniversary edition of Spice World called Spice World 25.
Hello, I'm Aurora, and you're listening to Q with Tom Power.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. If you happened to watch the Juno Awards, like the Canadian Grammys a while back, you would have caught a pretty amazing performance by Ace and Nobby. The reason it was amazing is not just because of his incredible voice, but he was wearing this coat that was decorated in 122 painted feathers, representing the number of unmarked graves found at residential schools across Canada so far. Ace and Nobby is from Soccer Clan of Sandy Lake First Nation. He kind of came out of nowhere last fall with his debut album that got a lot of attention. It's called Watin. The story behind it is really interesting. Ace and Nobby sat down and recorded conversations with his grandfather and asked him questions about surviving residential schools, about meeting the love of his life. And then he turned those stories into music. So I wanted to play this conversation because I think it's one of the best records I've heard out of Canada in a long time. Here's some of my conversation with Ace and Nobby. Let's talk a little bit about the record. That's a beautiful thing. Let's talk about the record. Watton?
Yeah.
It's your grandfather's name?
Yeah.
Is he still with us?
Yeah.
He graces the cover of the album. He's featured predominantly throughout the album. We're going to tell the whole story, but just tell me a little bit about him.
Yeah, so my grandfather, he's always been kind of the rock of the family, right? Like, always kind of a quieter dude and you know, worked really hard his whole life to kind of just, you know, provide for his family and always kind of a source of, like, stability and strength in the family. So, like, you know, a lot of these stories that we talked about were things that we'd never talked about before. So we kind of just grew the closest we've ever been through the process of making this record. It wasn't even a record at the time. It was conversations, right?
You were sitting down and talking to him about his life, about he had gone through.
Mm-hmm. But, like, when I think back on it, though, like, you know, he was always supportive of my music, too, to be honest. Like, I remember just being, like a teenager and playing bars and, you know, and he would, like, come and pick me up sometimes at, like, 2 a.m. and drop me off. You know what I mean? Yeah. And, like, he was... And so there's moments like that are really kind of precious to me. And because, you know, even then he was still old and probably would have preferred been sleeping. But he was just like, no, I'm going to come grab you. And so, like...
What made you want to sit down and talk to him like that and get his story?
So I used to work as a journalist too, right, up until March.
Yeah.
And...
You got out. Good for you.
and so March of 2020, my aunt, who was his power of attorney at the time, he was kind of having a lot of health complications and, you know, would be, you know, he'd fall down sometimes and then, like, would be, like kind of stuck on the floor. So, and until someone, like, his PSW would come into the place. So she made the decision to move him into a long-term care home. And so I flew up to Thunder Bay to move him into the place. And there was something about it, you know, just like... Like I said, him being the rock and him having, like, his own space, and, like, he's always kind of, you know, he has his house is his house, and to kind of just pack it all up for him and go through all these memories of his life and kind of put most of it into storage and then, like, just a few boxes into this long-term care space.
Where, yeah.
Anyways, long story short, I moved him into this place and I try to make it as homey as possible, and I fly back to Toronto, and then as soon as I land... like the pandemic is declared in Canada. And so I was working and it seemed like every other week there was like a outbreak at a different long-term care home. And it was just absolutely terrible for all the people who live there. Like some people weren't making it. And so I was calling him every day and that's kind of how these conversations started.
Can we listen to a little bit of this right now? This is one of the interludes. Take a listen to this.
Yeah, I was 8 years old and I went to a residential school. Somebody from outside, the government person, said if you don't send your kids out, you guys are not going to help you. That's why I went to school. They had no choice. It was over 300 kids that went to school. And I used to cry, I was lonesome. I was wondering why I was sent here. And I didn't know why. What did I do wrong?
That's the beginning of Asa Nabi's new album, Watin, and that's his grandfather discussing traveling to residential school there. What was it like listening to that when he told you those stories?
I've never seen him cry. I've never seen my grandfather cry. And even that clip, like, you know, he's never said anything like that to me before, like, about being lonesome. Yeah, you know, these conversations didn't start like that. They started with just kind of small talk, but then it kind of progressed.
It strikes me that he wanted to talk to you about it. Like, even if not at the beginning...
Well, I think I was pretty, you know, I was pretty kind of open to, like, when we started talking and, you know, there were stories he told me that I do remember were, and then when he retold them, he was forgetting certain parts and, you know, his memory was kind of wasn't as good as it used to be. And so that was kind of the point where I was like, wow, like you're the elder of our family, and you have like the most stories of who we are and where we come from and where our family comes from. And that's kind of like where the journalist came in, and I just asked him, like, do you mind if I record these conversations, and do you mind like talking to me and like, you know, getting real and kind of just like, you know, kind of talking about things we've never talked about before. And so, yeah, we spent like the first part of the year where I was basically interviewing my grandfather about his life. And
I mean, that has to be, like emotionally challenging for you too.
Yeah. Like, yeah, like I said, like even hearing that, like it still gets me, you know, cause I can,
yeah,
just, yeah, you know, never seeing him in that way. Like it almost makes you kind of question yourself a bit to being like, wow, like, you know, I had so much time before to kind of connect with him on this level. And, you know, it took kind of a global pandemic for us to kind of, you know, we were like 1,200 kilometers apart talking on the phone, and you know, we're just, and still like the closest we've ever been, you know? And so yeah, you know, I wish we had these conversations earlier, but still so glad.
Yeah.
We, you know, talked about it.
He must, is he happy to be on a big time record now? Or is he?
yeah. So it was, so when we got the masters back, he knew I was working on the record, and I think I showed him a couple of rough drafts like way earlier when I was in Thunder Bay before. But then when I got the masters back, I picked him up and I drove him around, and I put on the tracks.
Yeah.
And so the interludes weren't in there just for that one. And I played them. And, you know, I think it's, people are always kind of surprised when they hear me, like, oh, I wasn't expecting that. Right. And like, I sound different than I talk. And so I guess it's the same for my grandfather, because we're listening to this thing, right? I'm driving around, kind of looking at him, and he didn't, I don't think he knew it was the album until the last song.
Yeah.
Because, like, his voice is in the last song, and then he just kind of looked at, he's like, hey, I think I'm on the radio.
I think I'm on the radio.
and so that was, like, such a moment. But, you know, I think one of the things that, like, kind of makes me so happy about it is because, yeah, like, he, you know, he's living in a long-term care place. And it can be a very lonely place for the people who live there, you know, like,
yeah,
because, like, the staff have so much stuff to do.
Yeah, and yeah. They're underfunded. They're dealing with the best of what they have, yeah.
And so when this album's coming out, like, a lot of the staff there, I've been like, yeah, we're seeing this name pop up on Ace and Happy, and we're like, oh, that's your last name, and he's like, oh yeah, that's my grandson, and then so, you know, they're giving him all the updates, but then they're also learning so much about his story, and you know, so now, like, they kind of understand more about who he is and where he comes from and what he's been through, and so, yeah, Yeah, he just gets, you know, he's understood and he's appreciated, and that makes me really happy about, you know, one thing about this record.
I mean, I should say for people who don't know the record too well is that you we're going to play a song right now that you wrote in response to that clip we just heard from your grandfather a couple of minutes ago. Can we just take through this?
Took me from your father with a face full of dollars, with a neck of starboard. I don't even know my name. You took me from your mother, took me from your sister. Oh, brother, I don't even know my name. Won't you tell me, won't you tell me?
I'm Tom Bauer, this is Q. I'm speaking with Ace Nabi about his new album, Watin. So, take me through the process of that. Like, you do these interviews and write these songs based on what you hear, what you feel.
Yeah. So that song in particular was the first song that got, like, written for this. And it was like, so I was just listening to some of these conversations, And yeah, there was one conversation where we were talking about CC Bano. It's his dad's name, and I remember asking, like, "Oh, like what does like CC Bano mean?" And he didn't know what his father's name meant. Not that he had forgotten; he had just been, I guess, probably taken at such a young age that he didn't even have like the chance to learn so much about his family, including what your father's name means, right?
Mm.
And so that really kind of, you know, struck me. And as I was listening to that, like I was kind of noodling on the guitar and then started writing this song. And then I wrote the song and then wrote another song and then was just kind of like, oh, you know what? Like, I didn't know what I was going to do with these recordings. I knew I wanted to have these stories. Mm. You know, if I ever start a family of my own, to kind of be like, you know, this is our family history. And, you know, I just thought this would be a good way to kind of like maybe immortalize the story a little bit and kind of capture it.
Came and took us from our beds. I didn't know what was happening. I was 8 years old. Couldn't even say goodbye. I was told that there was not much time as we stepped to the cold. Till we were long gone. Till we were long gone. Till we were. They marched us down the road. Plane. Sit down and show your face as I live in years go by. Honey, I will meet you here. Honey, I will leave this place until we're both long gone. Until we're both long gone. Until we're both long gone.
That is Ace Inabi and a song called Long Gone from his brilliant album, Watin, which is out everywhere now. Before that, you heard my conversation with Ace Inabi. That is it for the show today. Tomorrow on the show, Guillermo del Toro picked up the Oscar for Best Animated Feature for his version of Pinocchio. If you haven't seen it, it's a little different. The fascist leader Benito Mussolini is one of the characters. Guillermo will tell you why he thinks the story of Pinocchio is ultimately the greatest story of resisting authority and why Disney films are darker than we think. That's tomorrow on the show. We'll see you then, later on.
As our living years go by, picturing the quiet life, my dear.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.